and welcome to Ipsa Dixit, a podcast on legal scholarship. I'm your host, Brian L. Fry, Spears Gilbert Professor of Law at the University of Kentucky College of Law. My guest is Matt Blaschik, incoming research fellow at the University of Michigan Law School. We will discuss his article, Impossibility of Emergent Works Protection in U.S. and EU Copyright Law, which is published in the North Carolina Journal of Law and Technology. So welcome to the show, Matt.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for the invite. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I'm really glad to have you on. This is a paper that's near and dear to stuff that I'm interested in myself. So I'm doubly delighted to talk to you about it.
Well, see, your writing influenced my thinking quite a bit on AI and copyright. The very first draft of this paper started as a thesis back in the UK at King's College London, and then I read your papers and your Twitter. Actually, listened to the podcast, so it's even more great to be here.
Awesome. Well, that's so wonderful to hear. I'm delighted to know that we're having, you know, that kind of scholarly conversation. For listeners who haven't perhaps engaged so much with AI and copyright yet, I wonder if you could start by talking a little bit about what you mean by emergent works, why you use that term, and what you would kind of put in that bucket, as it were.
Right. Well, emergent works are a term that we use to refer to works that weren't created with the aid or assistance of AI, but rather have emerged, so to say, from the state of nature. They weren't created by a human being, but rather are autonomous AI creations or autonomous creations of non-human beings. They look creative, they look like works, but there isn't a human author that's the causer of the work. This is exactly the kind of work that's currently litigated in the highly publicized failure case. And that's also what was at stake in the case of Naruto, where a monkey supposedly took selfies of itself without human intervention.
Okay, so just to clarify then, an emergent work is a category that includes at least some kinds, if maybe not all, AI-generated works, but includes other kinds of works as well, other than AI-generated works?
That's how I see it. So I think that anything that doesn't have a human author as well as the author as the causer of the work would be an emergent work, right?
So maybe then you could introduce listeners a little bit to kind of copyright theory, as it were. And I'm thinking specifically introduce them to how you think we ought to kind of conceptualize the ontology of copyright protection. In other words, what's the subject matter of copyright? Or maybe even better, why is the subject matter of copyright?
Right. Well, that's a great question. The approach that I took in this paper was to focus on the contrast between legal and natural ontology. This is to say that the law creates its own reality, that law sees certain things to be true and certain processes to lend legal effects. And this is different from occurs in nature or what some philosophers may take to be true. And I think this is, one of those foundational remarks to make, because a lot of the debate about AI creations tends to muddle this conceptual water. And as for copyright specifically, I think we can say that copyright is a creation of modernism, of enlightenment, of romanticism to a certain extent. And it starts with the figure of the human author who expresses certain ideas in an original way and thus creates a work. So works are obviously intangible, they aren't corporeal things, but are an institutional creation that's achieved through this expressive creative process of a human being. And this is obviously neither ideologically neutral, nor is it completely prone to deconstruction or some critical stances. I think, contrarily, I think it's very ideologically tainted, but that's not a bug, that's a feature. So I see the legalization, the process of how a copyrightable works is created. It's that we have a human author who expresses ideas, stamps them with his own personality or her own personality, with the creativity of their mind, doesn't take them from another person, creates them independently, and fixes them in a tangible medium, thus resulting in a work.
What do you think the necessary features that a work has to have in order to qualify as copyrightable subject matter? Not necessarily it's like a statutory matter, but it's like a conceptual matter would be. And more than that, I also kind of wonder to what extent are those features tied to what we mean by copyright, as opposed to what we want copyright to achieve.
A lot of legal scholars and articles emphasize the differences between the European and Anglo-Saxon legal traditions in respect to copyright. I think that, in fact, they aren't all that different. They both start with the figure of a human creator. So, in both jurisdictions, both in the EU and in the US, the conceptual building blocks are common, and I think the theory and the doctrine overlap. So we have the factual creator of a work, the author. The law in the US doesn't really define the author all that much. We know from case law that it is he who creates the work. We know that from the statute, we know that it's only original works that can be protected. This is supposedly a constitutional requirement. And we learn from the case law that for an authorial work to be original, it has to be independently created and with an addition of modicum of creativity, a stamp of personality, free exercise of creative choices. These metaphors are actually quite common both in the US and in the EU, used interchangeably, despite those supposed theoretical differences. And obviously, there is the requirement of fixation, but that's not really what we are concerned about today. So yeah, I think these are the four elements, right? Because there's also the idea expression dichotomy, which underlies this whole scheme. Copyright protects expressions of ideas. Not the idea itself, but a particular way of expressing it. This isn't very clear conceptually, right? In a lot of case law, it causes difficulties. It's not very clear because it goes back to Enlightenment philosophy of several German thinkers who tried to create a stable ontological basis for copyright. And this basis links back to the human author. So while we delineated the concepts, there is a certain circularity involved because each one defines another, and we see it in the way that cases are decided. They are decided usually through, different metaphors employed. They are slight linguistic variations, but they all come down to original work of human creativity, of human authorship. Yeah.
So, what then is the kind of missing quality or missing element in an emergent work that takes it out of that
Right.
basket? Part of what was interesting to me about your paper was it seemed to me like you're making an argument that there's a kind of ontological problem with emergent works that makes them uncopyrightable, apart from the question of whether or not it would make kind of practical sense to permit copyright protection of them in the first place.
This is exactly what's at stake in the currently litigated failure case, which is one of the test cases brought by Steven Taylor and Ryan Abbott, representing him in several jurisdictions, including in the US. And the case is interesting because it's meant to be a post-humanist challenge to the supposedly anthropocentric and supposedly an outdated or wrong, uncogent framework of US copyright law. And if you look at the facts of the case, at least the ones in the original administrative record, they say that the work was autonomously created by the machine. There is no human author, no one who provided creative choices that resulted in the output. So this is a very particular theoretical framing. It's kind of abstract because the case itself is meant to advance a contrary legal ideology, right? A different kind of ontology, or rather to show that the one that we have is anthropocentric and thus no good. It's anthropocentric, so it's romantic, and romantic means it's bad. Well, I think the analytical part is true in the sense that US copyright law, European copyright law, well, the British one as well, they do have this ideological heritage, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the law is somehow able to be deconstructed in the course of legal proceedings because, well, the statute delineates what it renders to be true. That's authorial creativity. Now we have other cases. So we had a few US Copyright Office's review board decisions, which looked at different factual scenarios. So we can see that a work isn't possibly completely autonomously created by a machine. Perhaps it's created with the use of a machine. Well, in fact, we create works with the use of machines. Every day we have for millennia, and those works, if the causal links aren't severed, if there is a foreseeable creative expression as linking from the author to the output, then they would be copyrightable. But if they aren't, then we wouldn't register them, right?
So maybe then you could talk more specifically about some of these test cases people have filed and kind of work through what they're arguing and why you think that the things that they're trying to do are inconsistent with these kinds of fundamental premises of copyright law.
Right, so I think on the one end of the spectrum we have the failure case. So that's a recent entry to paradise that, in the very factual background of the registration application, specified that it was created wholly autonomously. Then we had a slightly different case. There was Naruto. That wasn't actually a Copyright Office decision. It was a court case where, again, the question being litigated was whether a monkey can be an author. And the court said that no. Looking at the legislative history, at construing the text, it's only in the fruits of intellectual labor, in the creative power of the mind, that we can find the root cause of a work, and that has to be human, right? Now there are, with the AI technology advancing and with the variety of uses, we have more and more complex cases which require us to treat copyright causation slightly more seriously than we are used to. These kinds of analyses weren't really, employed at a very high level of analytical scrutiny. And one of the interesting cases was the one brought by Christina Kasztanova, who again applied for her work, Zarya of the Dawn, to be registered. And there, the copyright office actually found out that the work was created with the use of AI technology. And we went back to the whole circle of concepts and authorial creation analysis. But at the same time, we have a whole spectrum of cases, according to the recent the congressional letter of the Copyright Office. There have been 100 cases registered already, 100 works registered already, where the use of AI was such not to sever the creative links between a human author and the output. So the current guidance says that that which isn't authorial has to be disclaimed. One has to say what they created, what they didn't, what the AI's input was. And then one question is whether particular elements of a work are copyrightable. Another is whether the work as a whole, as a compilation, could be copyrighted. So whether it could be appropriated by the purported author. And this inquiry is very fact specific. It's very difficult, I think. And this is also why the failure case and this article took this most extreme example of a completely emergent work to be a wholesale challenge to the copyright doctrine and theory. Whereas most of the works that will be actually interesting are the ones that aren't as radically away from a human being, from a human author, and they require a much more thorough analysis of what the authorial intent was, what the author did, what prompts he used, what he foresaw, what he did not, and whether the unoriginal elements were somehow then appropriated in the larger whole of a work.
So when it comes to a more radical effort like Thaler's to register something stipulating that there's no non-autonomous input into the work being registered, what kind of argument are people kind of advocating for the registration of those kinds of works making? And why do you think those arguments are unavailing? Right. Is it because they shouldn't be registrable, or is it because they can't be registrable in some kind of like conceptual sense? Like, what's missing exactly, and why
Right.
does it matter so much?
Right. My piece was titled Impossibility of Emergent Works Protection. Well, impossibility is a bold linguistic choice. What does it mean to be impossible? And I think, it was a stylistic choice, but there are two interlinked concepts in positivist jurisprudence. One is inconsistency. The other is incoherence. So inconsistency would look at legal propositions and whether one logically follows from the other. And incoherence would look at the broader doctrinal shape, the whole architecture. And see whether this argument, whether this particular case conforms with the doctrine at large or doesn't. And I actually think that emergent works fail at in both regards. They are inconsistent because as we enumerated already, no offer, no expression, which can then be creative, and thus no creative or original and does no original work. And they are incoherent because the whole idea behind this is to promote human creative expression and to delineate what one deserves and what one does not deserve based on whether they made original creations. So in the first section of the article, I try to analogize this to more common property law metaphors. So, the 1L property courses starts with the concept of possession, with catching a fox, right? And did you actually catch the fox? Was the fox free to run away or not, right? And copyright doesn't employ the concept of possession because we are dealing with intangibles, but rather originality, right? And there is another angle here. One is that, whether it's your possession or the possession of another, so did you take it from someone else? Was there a previous possessor, or was it free to take in the state of nature, in the res communis, or in copyright in public domain? And the other question is, did you do enough? And there is the correlative question of, did you do enough to deprive the public at large of their free ideas, right? Did you appropriate the idea? Did you appropriate the nature to make it your own? And curiously enough, Failure starts off with saying that he didn't do enough. He didn't do anything really to appropriate the work in question. So it's as if he tried to, set out to lose. And this is exactly what happened in the district court. And now we will see what the Court of Appeals says. But what they try to do is blend the analytical and normative arguments. So, first of all, they claim that there is no requirement of human authorship in the Copyright Act or in the case law, I guess. That's difficult to justify, and this is also why they ultimately weren't successful, because the case law since the 19th century preceding the Copyright Act and since the Copyright Act itself interpreted authorship in squarely anthropocentric terms. And this is because copyright is an anthropocentric humanistic endeavor. And there are various legal arguments one can make, but they all fail if the factual specification is such that there is no human author. So, for example, they make a work for hire argument. So imagine that the AI can be an employee of yours, and AI creates, but you become an author through a legal fiction. Well, this is interesting, and this has received a lot of scholarly attention, but the underlying facts, the underlying foundation is again the same. First of all, AI isn't a legal person, so cannot be an employee, but putting that aside, if there wasn't anyone to create the work, no one can assign it to you and through the legal fiction make you the fictional author. So because the project is so radical and so philosophically motivated, well, that on a generous interpretation, then that's why it's a losing case.
I guess I can't help but wondering whether you think that people like Thaler actually want to win, or what winning would mean for them, and what they're trying to achieve, or what they're trying to say by what they're doing. And I guess more than that, like, what does this tell us more broadly about what copyright law means or tells us about creativity?
Right. So this is very interesting because, you know, we have Feiler and we have Abbott, the lawyer and a law professor who's representing him. And they've launched a plethora of those cases in many jurisdictions, both in copyright law and in patents. So, you know, we had the UK recently said that under British patent law, AI cannot be the inventor. The US Circuit Court said the same, and the Supreme Court didn't grant the writ. Now, they succeeded in some jurisdictions under patent law, I think in South Africa, and they have been, and actually that's a jurisdiction that has moved forward in granting patent protection to AI inventions. But ultimately, there is a curious blend of scientific and scholarly agenda here. So, you know, it's not only what copyright law is trying to do, but also what copyright scholarship is trying to do, right? What is scholarship trying to achieve? Is scholarship trying to just make an academic point, or is the very radical idea, right? AI can be a person, AI can be a creator, AI can be an inventor. Should this actually influence lawmaking? And well, so far mostly the answer is no, at least in the US and in the UK. But they've had some wins, and well, I think some people could be too quick to dismiss all of this as, you know, an endeavor of high personal ambitions. But I think there is an underlying discontent with not just with copyright law, but also with modern law at large, with modernity at large, maybe, right? Many philosophers, many scholars are uncomfortable with the place that human beings have in the law and in the world. And these are, you know, legitimate concerns. In the article, I tried not to argue philosophically, what role human beings have in the world. I try to argue from the perspective, from the normative perspective, from the ontological perspective of copyright law, what copyright law, or, you know, modern law at large, construes human beings to be, what role it delineates for them, and how human beings come to achieve their rights and obligations. But, you know, is this a legitimate, a politically legitimate project? That's a separate question. I think that's difficult to answer. The whole thing with the law, with at least how we came to understand it, is that it doesn't necessitate answering those big questions, right? Because the law has its own eye, it has its gaze, which renders certain things to be true, certain things to be not true in the law, right? In law, not in fact. And it's the ultimate fiction, quite like God was in pre-modern times, right? So that's the this is what Hans Kelsen wrote, right? That we replaced God with the state, with the law, and this is the foundational norm. And that which contradicts the norm cannot succeed in court, at least. Perhaps it can succeed a scholarship in the court of public opinion in our hearts, but I don't think in the circuit court. And this is actually, I think, quite interesting when you look at copyright ontology. We speak of the human mind, human creativity, and these seem, well, they are enlightenment concepts, right? But why are they limited to human beings? Well, in the copyrights or legal institutional reality, we know why. Well, the statute says so. The constitution says we, the people, we have the whole idea of popular sovereignty granted by the people, right? And again, we don't need to examine it because it all starts with the constitution. But if you look at the philosophical pedigree, most of the, and this is something that Schmidt wrote, most of the Enlightenment concepts are simply secularized versions of religious concepts. And it's, not without a reason, because both are narratives that humans invented to institutionalize their place in the world, to become the owners and meaning makers of the world. And there is a certain, quixotic attempt in trying to say, well, that's not true, that's not obvious, that's not a natural fact that a human being is supposed to be the owner or the meaning maker of the world. And like, duh, but that's the whole point, right? We created law, we created whatever ideologies, religions, literary traditions, and they do create a certain social order, which is non-obvious, which is non-natural, and it serves concrete goals.
So Matt, in closing, it seems to me that what you're saying is that on some level, copyright institutions are reaching, at least as a general matter, the right outcomes when it comes to emergent works. But I wonder if you think they're reaching those outcomes in the right way or for the right reasons. And if you wanted institutions to kind of reconceptualize or describe differently what they're doing in relation to emergent works, what would be like a key set of suggestions or observations you would make?
Right. So this is very interesting, because once again, we can say that copyright law reaches good outcomes in light of its architecture, in light of its doctrine, but we don't need to necessarily agree with the doctrine itself, or even with the institution of copyright. I mean, one can be the lawyer anarchist, right? Doesn't believe in the state, doesn't believe in ownership of ideas, doesn't believe that ideas and expressions are different, but then wears a different persona, a different mask in court, and there accepts those institutional institutional concepts in copyright's rendition, in the US law's rendition, as true, even if fundamentally they go against common sense. And I think many concepts of copyright go against, well, empirical findings. They aren't necessarily philosophically coherent, and you have written about that. Other authors have dabbled in this direction, and this is the thing about the monstrosity that the law is. It doesn't really allow for such a doubt. A more pragmatic question is, what the direction to be taken? What's the direction to be taken? And whether the US law will develop in a different way. I don't think that's likely to happen. I think that the case law and review board decisions have been very consistent in affirming the place of the human being in the grand architecture. The same is true in Europe. So we didn't really discuss this much, but the Court of Justice of the EU has blended all of the copyright concepts together, saying that it's author's own intellectual creation. So they reaffirmed this institutional reality by, removing any analytical doubts. Now, there are the jurisdictions which take a different route. The UK is somewhere in the middle. They don't really know where they are standing. They have a very strangely drafted statute, which is, as I argued elsewhere, inconsistent. But it's there. And then we have the Chinese decisions, which take yet another approach. But I just don't really see why we would try to demolish those foundational concepts of copyright while preserving copyright, right? Because maybe we should, maybe, you know, this is the nihilistic moment, right? We are doubting the institutions and we should drift off to another land which is completely different. But I think there is a bit of inconsistency in saying that I should own what I don't deserve according to the rules that we have, because I somehow deserve yet another legal monopoly. And somehow, you know, yes, I'm not the factual creator, I'm not the legal creator, I didn't supply originality. This isn't mine according to any philosophical theory underlying the law, but I should have it anyway, because if it exists, it should be mine. Well, that's not really convincing. And if the deconstructive approach is to achieve something, maybe it's supposed to be a part of a bigger rethinking of what we are trying to do as a society, both in the creative realm and more generally, you know, what art should be in the AI era of, you know, cheap production, but also what human beings should, what role human beings should take in a just world. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Matt, thanks so much for coming on the show and talking about your paper. I really enjoyed reading it, and I encourage listeners to check it out.
Great, thank you.
I can sing you tender songs of love. I can give you merry tales and joyous laughter. I can transport you to the realms of music. I can call you to join in the rhythmic dance. I can lull the babe to sweet repose, or waken in the aged heart soft memories of youthful days. No matter what may be your mood, I am always ready to entertain you. When your day's work is done, I can bring the theater or the opera to your home. I can give you grand opera, comic opera, or vaudeville. I can give you sacred or popular music, dance, orchestra, or instrumental music. I can render solos, duets, trios, quartets. I can aid in entertaining your guests. When your wife is worried after the cares of the day and the children are boisterous, I can rest the one and quiet the other. I never get tired, as you will never tire of me, for I always have something new to offer. I give pleasure to all, young and old. I will go wherever you want me, in the parlor, in the sick room, on the porch, in the camp, or to your summer home. If you sing or talk to me, I will retain your songs or words and repeat them to you at your pleasure. I can enable you to always hear the voices of your loved ones, even though they are far away. I talk in every language. I can help you to learn other languages. I am made with the highest degree of mechanical skill. My voice is the clearest, smoothest, and most natural of any talking machine. The name of my famous master is on my body and tells you that I am a genuine Edison phonograph. The more you become acquainted with me, the better you will like me. Ask the dealer.